annoying.
That's normal, that's what you do in the holidays.
Father and Son, the Holy Spirit, one God, Amen. Can I just serve you for a Bible? Augustine, can you give us a Bible? Oh, that's right, I got one.
We'll use it for now.
Alright. In the name of the Father and Son, the Holy Spirit, one God, Amen. So welcome everyone to the Bible study. We're up to chapter 9 of Genesis. So we've been studying Genesis. So we started from the beginning, chapter 1 through now we're up to 9. Okay, so just to recap where we're up to. So we start with God creating the world, and He makes man perfect, He makes humanity perfect, He makes the world perfect. And humanity, we see the entrance of sin into the world. So it starts with disobedience. We see in the next, as Cain and Abel, we see the idea of anger and murder, and how that enters into the world. Selfishness. We move into Noah's Ark times where sexual sins take over the world. Angelos. We see how sexual sin enters into the world and God has to restart. Okay? And so what God does is He restarts. So humanity is made perfect and good. Okay? It's made perfect and good. And then God, He needs it to be good. But it's gone bad. So He restarts. And you'll see this as a theme throughout the next, as you read through the Old Testament. What God does is He restarts with humanity. Every now and then, humanity is completely wrong, and He restarts. So He starts with Adam, He restarts with Noah, He starts again after the Tower of Babel, He starts again with Abraham, and He continues to do this. Why? So He can have the opportunity for the Virgin Mary to bear Christ to save humanity. Okay? So that's the... And so we read today after Noah's flood. So up to the end of Noah's flood, humanity has been wiped out and humanity is being restarted. And the previous chapter finishes with Christ restarting, saying, be fruitful and multiply, the same command He gave at the beginning to Adam and Eve. So let's read. So we need designated readers. I'll read the it's got to be someone close. Mike. All right, so you read the quotes we have. I'll read the Bible. Okay. All right, so we'll start with... we'll read verse 1. In the name of the Father, and the Son, and the Holy Spirit, one God, Amen. So God blessed Noah and his sons and said to them, be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth. So as we saw last time, that it's the exact same command, be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth, is the exact same command that He gave Adam and Eve at the beginning. It's the same command. And so we see that lesson of restart, renewal, beginning. Okay? And the lesson that Father Tadros Malti gives us when we get the quote up is that God gives us a second chance. We have a second chance. So we need to make sure we give ourselves that second chance. No matter what we've done in our lives, no matter what sins we're stuck in, no matter what fights we are in with other people, no matter what we are in, give ourselves a second chance to restart. At the same time, give other people a second chance. Give other people another chance. And we'll see, as you go through the rest of the Old Testament, God gives chance after chance after chance, and He does not stop His chances. He does not finish them until he gives his own son. So he doesn't, it's not that he's limited in the amount of opportunities he gives. So we are the same. At a minimum, we should be giving people a second chance. Another chance. Mikey, you can read.
Gives us a chance to start again fresh. Give people that chance. Give yourself that chance. From a wounded head of formality. There's no any sons left the ark to the earth, renewed by the water and the great flood. God blessed them and granted them what he previously granted Adam and Eve. Be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth. As though man has started anew, or as though the world set forth anew through knowing the place of the first Adam.
So the lesson is, we need to give ourselves a chance to start fresh. Particularly when it comes to our spiritual lives, but also when it comes to our relationships with other people. We need to be able to have that chance to start again. Without necessarily blaming. I was just listening to a sermon today about the reconciliation between the churches. You know, say for example, the Orthodox Church, the Coptic Orthodox Church and the Greek Church. And they got to the point where they agreed on a statement of faith. We've always argued about the man Christ. And we've argued for centuries and centuries and centuries. And then it got to the point where we agreed. We said, we believe each other. But then there was a problem of, but you were wrong originally. And your saints are not my saints, etc., etc., etc. And the person giving the talk said that the only way that there'll be reconciliation between the two churches is if we both acknowledge that we don't have to say who was wrong to begin with. Even if I think you were wrong to begin with, I don't need that acknowledgement. Because you can't move past that. The churches can't move past that. Individuals can't move past that. So unless we're willing to just forego that and let ourselves start new, from now on, forget the past, from now on, then we can't move on. And that's what Christ and God did for the world time and time and time again, until he gave his only son, without putting blame. All right, so let's read now verses 2 to 7. And the fear of you and the dread of you shall be on every beast of the earth, on every bird of the air, on all that move on the earth, and on all the fish of the sea. They are given into your hand, every moving thing that lives shall be food for you. I have given you all things, even as the green herbs. But you shall not eat flesh with its life, that is, its blood. Surely, for your lifeblood I will demand a reckoning. From the hand of every beast I will require it, and from the hand of man, from the hand of every man's brother, I will require the life of man. Whoever sheds man's blood, by man his blood shall be shed. For in the image of God he made man. And as for you, be fruitful and multiply. Bring forth abundantly in the earth and multiply in it. So we have here the law of Noah. So we'll find, as we read through, there's certain laws that God gives to humanity. This is the law of Noah. It's the first rule law. Besides him saying that you can't eat the apple, there's been no law up to this point. We talk about Jewish law. In the church we have rules and laws. At this point there has been no law, except this one. So there's a couple of things that he says. The first one is that we're allowed to eat flesh. You know, it's not our right from the beginning to eat meat. You know, we complain about fasting a lot. But you know, from the beginning, we were designed as herbivores, at least according to the Bible. Not necessarily herbivores. Maybe there was a time when we were going to eat meat. But this is the first instance when it's said that we can eat meat. That's the first thing. But specifically, it says that we can't eat meat with their blood in it. You know, does anyone know what the word halal means? What does it mean? Everyone knows what halal means. Huh? Yeah, you kill it. You have to kill it before you eat it. Huh? But how do you kill it? That's the question. Halal is a specific type of killing. Huh? Cut its throat. Why? To drain its blood. Exactly. Are we bound by that now? Do we have to eat halal food now? Are we allowed to eat any type of meat that we want? Yes. Again, it's a very important point. I mean, I've talked about this before, that I remember one time we went out with the youth when I first started here at Amba Brahm, and we went to, it was before the fast, so we went to like a steakhouse. And the question came up from more than one person, are we allowed to eat food with its blood? Right, as though we're Jewish or we're Muslim? Yes, we are. Yes, we are. Please get that in your heads. We're not bound by the laws of the Old Testament. We're not bound by the laws of the Old Testament. We can eat anything. Father Tadros Malachi, I'll get you to read it.
Yep.
He gives some practical explanations about why we weren't allowed to eat it.
Father Tadros Malachi, physically forbidding man to eat or drink blood was for protecting his own health and behavioristically protect him from getting savage and violent. But spiritually, it is meant to sanctify blood as representing life delivered for the sake of salvation of man. This is where halal comes from.
No, that was me. Okay. So this is where the concept of halal comes from. The Muslims got it from the Jews, okay? But we are not at all bound by this, okay? At all. Okay, just to make it clear for everyone. All right, the other secondary law. So the first law is we're allowed to eat meat. The second law is about the idea of shedding blood, shedding man's blood. So whoever shed man's blood, by man, his blood shall be shed. For in the image of God he made man. The first thing to note about that is that this reaffirms man's dignity. So God made man in his image and likeness from the beginning. And we talked a lot about the dignity of humanity, okay? How important we are before God, so we don't throw away ourselves as nothing. The idea of self-esteem, the idea of throwing away our purity for nothing, lying for nothing, just for a bit of money, for a bit of dignity, for a bit of, you know, I fight, I get angry easily, as though it's nothing, as though we mean nothing, and what we do means nothing. This again reaffirms it. God cannot stand the idea that a human kills another human being because of the dignity of that person as being killed. It's not right before God that man takes the life of another man. And everyone, of course, reading this says, thank God I'm not planning on killing anyone, so I can just skip this part of the talk. I'll just tune out for a little bit because I have no intention of killing anyone. Right? But what is the new murder? And it's very clear in the New Testament. It's up there on the slides. What's the new murder? I'll get Mike to read that for us. Matthew 5.
New murder, Matthew 5:21. You have heard that it was said to those of old, you shall not murder, and whoever murders will be in danger of judgment. But I say to you that whoever is angry with his brother without a cause will be in danger of the judgment. And whoever says to his brother, Raka, shall be in danger of the council. But whoever says, you fool, shall be in the danger of hellfire.
So the new murder is anger at our brethren. And it says here that if you are angry without a cause. Okay, so what Jesus says is that there is times that there's cause to be angry. There is cause to be angry. But again, I heard a sermon today that was saying that it's not a sin to be angry. What's a sin is what you're angry about and what you do about it. So here's the sin here. Whoever says to his brother, Raka, or fool is danger of hellfire. You know, we often read the Old Testament as though it's much harsher than the New Testament. But it's clear that the New Testament is actually much harsher than the Old Testament. Much harsher. Danger of hellfire for saying fool to your brother. And when they say brother, it's any other human being. It's not just your brothers at home, which is normally the people we treat the worst. Our family. Normally we treat them the worst. But it's anyone. It's anyone. So that's the new murder. So we can't look at that. And why? Because of the dignity of that person. God has instilled them with dignity. They are in the image and likeness of God, even if they've done wrong. I can be angry at them for their sake to bring them back, but not just to call them a fool. Not just because I hate you because of what you've done. That's not, that is danger of hellfire. All right, so we'll move on to the next. We'll read verses 8 to 16, the covenant of God with Noah. Then God spoke to Noah and to his sons with him, saying, And as for me, behold, I establish my covenant with you and with your descendants after you, and with every living creature that is with you, the birds, the cattle, and every beast of the earth with you, all that go out of the ark, every beast of the earth. Thus I establish my covenant with you. Never again shall all flesh be cut off by the waters of the flood. Never again shall there be a flood to destroy the earth. Okay, we'll stop there actually. So God makes a covenant. What's his covenant? So a covenant, what's a covenant? No, it's not just a promise, it's a contract. It's a contract. So it says, so a covenant is a promise, but it's also to say, you do this, I do this for you. You do this for me, I do this for you. And throughout the Old Testament, you'll see a number of covenants, some very powerful ones, for example, with Abraham. But God does covenants with people. So what's this covenant? What's our requirement and what's his requirement? I mean, if you read it carefully, he's asked for nothing. God has asked for nothing. What his covenant is that I will not destroy humanity by a flood ever again. He's bound himself to begin with by a covenant. So Father Tadros Malati says that covenant, any covenant with God is a blessing. It's a blessing for you. It's access for you to his riches. So he's saying, look, I'm going to enter into contract with you. But you know, as anyone knows, when you enter into a business contract, the power lies with the person who's rich. Or if you have a resource. We have nothing. Well, he has everything. So it's a blessing for us. Mike, if you read that one. Oh, wait, I skipped. There was one before that. Can you go back?
Covenant is a blessing from God, Father Tadros Malati. He blessed humanity, presenting it with a law to submit to, a covenant to attach it to him, and a mark to support it in the days of his sojourn on earth.
Okay, so he blessed us with a way to live. Okay, the next thing that Abun Tadros Malati says is the next quote, Monica, is that God is proud of his covenant. God is proud. Like, I want you to notice when you read the Bible and the way God talks about humanity is that all the compliments are from God towards humanity. You know? He compliments humanity and he says, you are my son. Call me Abba, Father. You know, all these massive compliments towards humanity, not the other way around. God is proud. Oh, Monica.
Proud of his covenant with man. It is amazing how God, in his love for man, is proud of his covenant with him, saying, my covenant and my rainbow.
Okay, so the next one we've already spoken about. Monica, if you skip it. Yeah, that's St. Ephraim, what we were talking about before, about God binding himself. Yeah.
God thus bound himself before him by his promise that even if mankind were constantly to follow the thoughts of their imagination, he would never again bring a flood upon them.
So Saint Ephraim is saying that even God is binding himself by this covenant, that even if he's asked for nothing in return, that even if man goes wrong again, I'm not going to do that again. Okay, that's the covenants of God. And so the lesson I wanted to take away from that is God enjoys to make covenants with humanity. So let's make covenants with God. Whether they be secret or whether they be overt. Let's make covenants. And the covenants you'll find throughout the Old Testament are, you be my people and I will pour blessing upon you. I will give you land. I will give you joy. I will give you this. I will give you that. I will give you everything. Just all you have to do is be my people. All you have to do is listen to what I say. All you have to do is follow my laws. Simple. Don't kill other human beings. Simple. You're allowed to eat meat now. Don't lie. Honor your parents, etc., etc. You'll see as we go through the New Old Testament. It's very simple. And then I'll be your God. But don't come back asking me for anything if you don't want to enter into the covenant with me. You know, the Jewish people in the Old Testament are different from everyone else because of that covenant. Because of that relationship they have with God. God said to them, listen, you're my people. And therefore do this, this, and this. And if you do that, I'll give you everything. If you don't, then I'm going to destroy you. And then they don't do it. And then he says, all right, fine, I'll give you another chance. All right, I'll give you another chance. So let's enter into covenants with God. That's why, you know, we encourage, for example, the HSC students. We encourage them to enter into a covenant with God. Say, listen, if you want something from God at the end of your HSC, do this, this, and this. Work on your spiritual life. At the same time, study hard. At the same time, read the Bible every day. Simple things. We're not asking them to do much more than their responsibility. And then God gives them gifts. You know, there was one year at St. Mark's, there was a group of kids that went through where at least 5 or 6 kids in the class got into degrees way above what they got, their mark. And so you think they got their mark and you think, all right, they entered a covenant with God and God didn't give them what they wanted. Right? They got, instead of getting 99, they got 90. Oh my God, what a disaster. Right? And then they get into courses of 98, 99. And I remember everyone at that year was shocked. Like, what is going on with that class? How come they all got marks way above what they should have? No explanation. It's not like the cutoff just dropped that year. It didn't drop. They just got into courses that were outrageous. And you think to yourself, that must have been a class that had a secret covenant with God. Something must have happened between them and God. It can't be a coincidence that that many kids in one Sunday school class, it just happened for them. You know, again, I'd like to tell you the concept of a secret covenant with God. You know, in Acts, there's this statement in Acts where it says, and then St. Paul shaved his head because he had basically a covenant with God. You know? It's just this by the by, chucks it out there and doesn't say anything about what it is. Just St. Paul had a covenant and he just shaved his head and he moved on. And it just gives you a little bit of insight into the character of St. Paul. He understood God well. He understood that if I want God to help me in my service, if I want God to help me in my life, then I make a covenant with him. I say, listen, God, I'm willing to do the things I'm supposed to do. Like, you know, when we make covenants with God, we're not doing anything more than what we're supposed to do. You know, if you go over and above that by giving up something that is my right or something that is not wrong, you know, if you say to God, listen, I'm not going to watch TV, or I've been wronged badly and I'm willing to apologize instead of them apologizing to me, I'm willing to forego it. Of course, that gives you much, much, much more blessing. But even I'm willing to read the Bible every day, I'm willing to pray every day, what I'm supposed to do, even that, God is willing to accept that as a covenant. Willing to accept it and say, listen, okay, fine, I'll pour my blessings on you to teach you. And I challenge you. I challenge you to try it. I challenge you to try it with God and see what happens. Because I guarantee that God will honor it because he wants you to understand the concept. He wants you to get it for the rest of your life. That if I fast and pray, then God will answer my prayer. If I give up something for God, he will hear me. And Abuni Oboz used to say that it's as much as you want is as much as you give up. If you want something big from God, give up something big. If you want something big, don't give up something that's very easy. If you struggle for him, he'll give you. So that God is covenantal. In the Old Testament, he's very covenantal and he's teaching us a lesson that we can approach him in that way. He's happy for us to approach him in that way. As a covenant.
Next slide.
So I'll read the up till verse 17. And God said, this is the sign of the covenant which I make between me and you, and every living creature that is with you for perpetual generations. I set my rainbow in the cloud, and it shall be for the sign of the covenant between me and the earth. It shall be when I bring a cloud over the earth that the rainbow shall be seen in the cloud. And I will remember my covenant, which is between me and you and every living creature of all flesh. The waters shall never again become a flood to destroy all flesh. The rainbow shall be in the cloud, and I will look on it to remember the everlasting covenant between God and every living creature and all flesh that is on the earth. And God said to Noah, this is the sign of the covenant which I have established between me and all flesh that is on the earth. So the other thing about covenants is that it's confirmed with a sign. It's confirmed with a sign. From God's side, the sign here is the rainbow. From God's side, the sign is that he honors his side. He honors. You know, I have two parties. If I enter in covenant with God, who's more honorable? Who's more likely to hold their end of the bargain? Of course it's God. If you keep your side, he can't not keep his side. He can't. These are his promises. You know, you read through the Old Testament, these are his promises. It's given to us from the church that this is true. If I read something in here as a promise from God, then I can say to God, listen, this is your promise. You have to give it to me if I honor it, because that's your promise. You're more honorable than me. And let's make a sign of our covenant. You know, always in the Old Testament, you'll see that, for example, Joshua, he beats an army or whatever, or he crosses a river, and he says, listen, I'm going to make a sign for perpetual generations to show my covenant with God, that my house is for God. And he does a sign of some description. Make a sign of your covenant. Use something in your life that reminds you of your covenant. Reminds you. Whether that be an area in your house, whether that be an icon, whether that be a written contract between you and God. Something that's a sign of the covenant between you and God. It's a sign. And it's not something that's outrageous and baloney, when that's how we deal with each other. Isn't it? Like, if I agree with you for something and I don't trust you, then what do? I make you sign it. I make you write it. I make you record it. You know, these days when, you know, the Telstra or whatever, they call you up and they want to sign you up to their phone. They make voice recordings of it, because that is a sign of the covenant. If I agreed, and then they go and throw it back in your face if you say, no, I never agreed. And they say, well, hold on, I have a recording. And you hear your voice saying, I agree. You know, because you weren't really listening to what was happening on the other side. You know? So we do that with each other. Why wouldn't we do that with God? Why wouldn't He deal with us like that? As a covenant. Alright. So now we're going to enter into a mistake from Noah. So let's read verse 18 to 23. Now the sons of Noah who went out of the ark were Shem, Ham, and Japheth. And Ham was the father of Canaan. These three were the sons of Noah, and from these the whole earth was populated. And Noah began to be a farmer, and he planted a vineyard. Then he drank of the wine and was drunk, and became uncovered in his tent. And Ham, the father of Canaan, saw the nakedness of his father, and told his two brothers outside. But Shem and Japheth took a garment, laid it on both their shoulders, and went backward and covered the nakedness of their father. Their faces were turned away, and they did not see their father's nakedness. Alright, the first thing. Noah got drunk. So he planted a vineyard, and he got drunk. Did Noah do wrong? Why? Justify your answer. Yep, okay, very good. So at this point, there's no law to say that anything against drunkenness. That's one point. Any other reasons why Noah may have been wrong or not wrong? Anyone got any thoughtful ideas? So, I mean, most of the fathers generally are pretty gentle on Noah and say he's not wrong in this. For a couple of reasons. One, at this point, maybe, you know, before the flood, people did understand what wine did to them. But they say that Noah probably didn't understand what wine did to him. So he didn't know that fermented wine would make you drunk and sleepy and make you do crazy things, you know, make him get naked. Okay? He didn't know. So therefore, he can't be blamed. Two, there's no law. Although all the fathers say that there's also no law to say you can't uncover your father's nakedness. You know, or you have to respect your father, or anything like that. But they do say that there's a natural law. So, whether Noah was wrong or right, I mean, Abuna Tadros Malati says, well, look, we don't know if he was wrong or right. In any case, he suffered the consequences of it. He suffered the consequences of it. Because there is a natural law in our hearts, from God, that makes it wrong. For a number of reasons. Drunkenness. All right, so the next question, is alcohol wrong? Justify your answer. You read it already.
Yeah.
Yeah, but like, justify it.
No, I agree with exactly what I read. I mean, nothing comes with you, you know. If you have, you know, say one glass of wine, I mean, you can still drive a car without being, you know, impaired, like car driving being impaired or not legally. But it's only when you have, you know, maybe more than three or two drinks or something else.
Yep, that's exactly right. David?
I think that with alcohol, polish the issue, it's when your actions are affecting the positive. So like when you haven't had too much, but don't you say it kind of causes you to think that's when it becomes bad, but you just have it blown out and nothing to do with it.
Historically, wine was fermented to make it last longer, and that's the only reason we did ferment wine. Sorry, we didn't have refrigerated preservatives.
I didn't know that.
Why we use alcohol? That's why we fermented.
And then they drank it and discovered that they got drunk.
So the law of Moses and the laws of the Old Testament teach us not to become drunk. It never says not to drink, and that's because they had no other option. So you sort of delve into the teachings of the same form. He tells us, although these are lawful for us, they're not good for us. And we now know that alcohol is in fact a toxin. It suppresses your inhibitions, impairs your judgment, your coordination.
That's exactly right.
By modern standards,
alcohol?
Yeah.
No. No. And that's what St. John Chrysostom is saying. So alcohol is not a sin. And in fact, what's the biggest testament to that? Like, as a practical thing, what's the biggest testament to that? Communion. We use it every single Sunday. Alcohol. An alcoholic beverage as our communion. Fedi, you want to answer? No, no, that's right. That's 100% true. I mean, that's exactly what St. Paul is saying, that things are lawful for me, but not necessarily good for me. But the church does not teach that alcohol is wrong.
Would it be lawful for priests to say, to drink, to take a glass of wine with
them? Abuna. Would you like me to answer the question? Yeah. All right. yes, it is lawful for a priest to drink wine.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So if you go across the world, you'll find that Russian priests drink because it's part of their culture. Serbian priests drink wine, it's part of their culture. There's nothing wrong with it. What is wrong with it? The problem, for example, okay, there's two different questions there. So for the priest, it's a different question, or even the servant in a class is different to everyone, okay? Because of the example that we're setting. So if someone sees a priest drinking a glass of wine with his dinner and they're 14 years old, are they going to be able to interpret that in a way that, ah, yes, alcohol is okay, but not excessive alcohol, and therefore I'll drink this much and not this much? They can't interpret it correctly. Therefore, the priest, in his wisdom, avoids it. He wouldn't do it to teach the lesson. Okay? But is it wrong? Is God upset with the priest in the privacy of his own home to drink a small amount of wine? I don't think so. I don't think so. Would the priest be wise to avoid it? Yes, definitely. As Fedi said, it's an escalating thing. You know, in practice, as a GP, one thing I discovered is that there's a lot of alcoholics out there who have no concept that they're alcoholics. No idea. They come in and their liver tests are way off. And you say, do you drink alcohol? Oh, a little bit. Okay, how much do you drink? Oh, maybe between me and my husband, 3 bottles of wine. I'm like, oh, okay. So that's a bottle and a half of wine a night. They say, oh, Liam, give or take. Right? I go, you're an alcoholic. Oh, no, I'm not, doc. They've got no idea that they're destroying their body. That every night they lose their inhibition because, or they get they get immune to it because they do it every single day in the environment of their own home. So it's a dangerous thing. It is a dangerous thing, particularly if you do it outside. And we'll see a couple of examples of things that it can make you do. But but in and of itself, alcohol is not wrong. In fact, everything God created is not wrong. And that's the whole purpose of what we were saying from the beginning. From everything God created is good, is perfect. We corrupt it. We, by excessive, like using it excessively, using it in social environment in ways that are bad, we corrupt it. So then alcohol is wrong. So then becomes a problem for a lot of people. And so for that alcoholic, what do I say to them? I say, listen, you need to stop drinking, full stop. From a health perspective, forget religious. Why? Because if they drink one, they have to drink a whole bottle. They don't know how to stop. They're incapable of stopping. For the teenagers in the room, I say there's a number of them. The reason why we say stay away from it completely is because you have no idea the effect it will have on you. Same with gambling. You have no idea when you have one how much you'll enjoy it to have more. The effect it has on you, how much you enjoy it. And even if it's only one off, even as Noah, we'll see here now, even if it's just one off, it has devastating consequences. Devastating consequences. So we warn against it, of course we do. But in and of itself, it's not wrong. Is that all right, Abuna? I didn't want to get myself into
it. The other thing that ethanol as a substance, it's like medication. If it were to be prescribed as a medication today, it wouldn't be approved by the government. So for any government to approve any medication to be used, example, morphine, you use it for pain. And you find people that are in severe pain, you give them morphine, they don't get addicted to morphine. Because they are using it for something. And even St. Paul said to Timothy, his disciple, and Timothy was a bishop as well. He said to him, use alcohol in a small amount for your ailment. For he had a stomach problem and something like that. So as Abuna said, the use of the substance. But again, we have to go back to another question, that our church is an ascetic church, that we actually strive like, you know, put pressure on ourselves and control what we eat, control what we drink. Fast nearly 2/3 of the year. So for a person that really loves God and knows that this poison can actually affect him in one way or the other. Example with smoking. Okay? If 10 people start smoking at the age of 14 or 15, at least 5 of them will never be able to stop. And that's a big like, you know, nicotine addiction from the addiction or the habituation to the habit itself. But if those people, the same 10 people, one of them will be addicted to alcohol. So at least it's not safer than other people.
Yeah, cocaine's not too bad.
It might open a massive danger for a second. By that exact standard, if, say, marijuana was to be legalized, marijuana is dead set. Now, from a medical standpoint, we know that marijuana is a lot less toxic to the body than alcohol. Effect is far less, and even when you're completely high, you're nowhere near as bad if you were to have a drug. Now, if you look at, say, cultural perspective, where marijuana was used for ale, actually, up until about the 1930s, marijuana was used in common pharmaceutical, THC. If you were to use marijuana in a culture which had used marijuana for medicinal purposes, as our tradition has continued to use alcohol, marijuana is therefore not sick.
Yeah, if there was a culture that was stock standard and everyone in the culture did it, then maybe before God it wouldn't be wrong for that particular person in that particular culture. Why is it wrong for us? Because why is it wrong for us is because, I mean, if from a health perspective, it's extremely damaging to the health, to the mind.
Nowhere near as damaging as, say, alcohol.
Yes, and alcohol, yes, but alcohol in excess is wrong. That's what I'm saying.
Anything in excess is wrong. Alcohol in its entirety is alcohol is the only one drug that only takes because of you. Of all the drugs that we have, it gives you no benefit whatsoever.
No, they reckon that a small amount of red wine can give you cardioprotective. Yeah, yeah.
That you find in red wine, not to say a cognac. I'm very anti alcohol. I don't drink, I don't do drugs.
Yeah. No, I understand what you're saying. But, I mean, THC, the church considers wrong for the very reason of its damaging effect. Okay, and yes, it's not as culturally acceptable. Maybe if there was a culture, or it was culturally acceptable, we would accept
it. It's a matter of time for it to come legalized. But we'll say it, and these people say it in their life.
No, I don't think it will be legalized. I don't think so. I disagree with that.
Anyway,
well, in America, they use it as a painkiller. There's marijuana clinics. For them, is it wrong?
Well, marijuana is legalized now in 4 states.
Yeah, and they use it for pain. So, but we'll talk about it after a while. But look, drugs, generally speaking, wrong. Alcohol in excess, wrong. Alcohol in and of itself, not wrong.
Why can't I apply that same standard to a joint? Why can't that same standard
not be a problem?
We can talk about it after.
Okay.
All right. All right. But generally speaking, alcohol is not wrong. Drugs are wrong. Okay? Just take that as a rule. All right. John Chrysostom says this. If you could read for us, Mike. John Chrysostom's quote.
One hour of drinking.
No, go back.
Saint John Chrysostom, perhaps on the other hand, someone might say, why was vine dressing, source of such terrible wickedness, introduced into life? Do not idly blur down what comes into your head, O man. Vine dressing is not wicked, nor is wine evil. Rather it is uses them in it.
Okay. So that's what we're saying about alcohol. All right, so just some other dangers from drinking. Okay, just some of the quick dangers. So St. Jerome and St. Ambrose comment on what happened to Noah because of his drinking. Okay, Mike, if you can read for us.
St. Jerome, 1 hour of drinking has spared Noah, who for 600 years remained dignified. St. Ambrose says, how far the authority of wine goes, it made him drink the water.
Okay, so what they're saying is that someone who spent his whole life dignified, strong, lost all dignity under the influence of alcohol. So it can make you completely lose your dignity. The other thing it can do is it makes you commit sins that you are generally incapable of sinning. For example, there's many stories of someone who goes to a party, a virgin, goes to a party, gets drunk, and loses their virginity, although they had the strength to keep their virginity. There was no intention there, there was no relationship there, and they go to a party and completely lose their purity under the influence of alcohol. There's a very common story. It's a very, very common story. Or, more common examples that we see on the news all the time, violence. Makes people do violent things that they would never have done in other circumstances. How many times have we read about these king hits and people dying, a fight someone falls and hits his head, etc., etc., etc.? So, and I mean, part of the answer to Mike's question is that for some people, even a little bit of alcohol is wrong for that individual because of what it does to them and their incapacity to control it. That's why the church warns against it. That's why the church warns heavily against it, because of those few people that will suffer badly at the hands of it. So remember always that drunkenness carries a consequence. The other thing that drunkenness can do is it can make other people sin. You can bring other people into your circle of sin when you drink. You encourage other people to drink. You might be violent to someone else and make him commit an act of violence or anger. You might make someone else commit an act of impurity. In this case, Noah's drunkenness caused his son or his grandson to sin against him. You know, so it brings other people into that circle of sin. So what was Ham's or Canaan's sin here? There's two things that he did wrong. And it's very unusual here, but Canaan gets blamed for the sin, right? When it says that Ham did it. Does anyone have any insight into that? I mean, I'm not sure, but a lot of people comment that it was probably... we'll talk about it at the end, actually. I'll have a slide there for it. All right. So the first thing is that Ham uncovers... or doesn't cover up his father's nakedness or his sin. He uncovers his father's nakedness. And so the lesson, of course, is that who covers our sins? Who's the ultimate person that covers humanity's sins or my individual sins? God, Christ. That's the whole purpose of the cross. He comes and takes my sin and he removes it. So what are we supposed to do? The same thing. With other people's sins, we're supposed to cover other people's sins. Even if their sin is against me, I'm supposed to cover other people's sins. Certainly, if I'm not going to cover their sins, I shouldn't be uncovering other people's sins. How often are we guilty of telling other people the wrongs of other people? That did you see what this guy did or what they said or how they did it? Or even in confession, people will come and confess other people's problems. And that's why I got angry. Because she said this, this and this, and the way you should have seen the way she said to me, and la la la, and that's why I got angry. Honestly, that's what people do. That's what people do. People like to justify their actions. So, we should never, ever, ever be uncovering other people's sins. It's a godly characteristic to cover other people's sins, because Christ is the one who did that for us. So, Mike, can you just read that?
Father Tapas Malachi, if we in faith consider everyone as our father, mother, brother, or sister, it is fitting for us not to bear anyone, but as far as possible cover him or her in love in Jesus Christ who covers us.
Okay. The next thing that he did that was wrong, that again was part of the natural law because they have not yet got the commandments, is that he did not honor his father. He did not honor his father. And that is by nature. By nature, you know to honor your parents. Christ has said it on multiple occasions in the Gospel, in the Old Testament, in the Gospels. But Ham should have known that. And that was his problem. So the other thing is we need to be sure to honor our parents. To give them the dignity due to them, even if they've done wrong. Even if they've made a mistake. We have to cover their sin and we must honor them. That is a natural law from God. And not only natural, he's commanded it on multiple occasions. And that's the other mistake that Ham did here. So, Ambrose.
Ambrose, when we read that he was blessed, who was blessed by his father, and that he was cursed by his father, we learn above all else with great reverence to show our parents. And God gave his privilege to our parents, so as to arouse respect in the children. The formation of the children is then of the parents. Therefore, honor your father, that he may bless you.
Okay, so we must honor our parents even if they've done wrong. Even if they've done wrong. Whether it's they've genuinely done wrong or my perception is that they've done wrong. In any case, we must honor our parents. And that was a big mistake from him. And we see that he gets cursed badly because of it. Because he did not give his father due dignity. He should have known to see my father naked lying on the floor there. It's not correct for me to go and get someone to have a look at his sin. He must have known that. But still he thought it was funny. Let me tell my brother. Let me uncover his sin. And the same is, I mean, many times in life, the same is for anyone around us. It's funny sometimes the mistakes they make. Their mistakes are funny to us. It's humorous. It makes me popular to point it out. But it's a big error. It brings God's curse on us. Because he does not want that person humiliated. He doesn't want the humiliation, and if I'm the one causing the humiliation, then there's a problem. I'll read verse 24 to 29. So Noah awoke from his wine and knew what his younger son had done to him. Then he said, "Cursed be Canaan, a servant of servants. He shall be to his brethren. Blessed be the Lord of the God of Shem, and may Canaan be his servant. May God enlarge Japheth, and may he dwell in the tents of Shem, and may Canaan be his servant." And Noah lived after the flood 350 years, so all the days of Noah were 950 years, and he died. Alright, so there's a bit of confusion about the order of Noah's sons, who's who, and that kind of thing. So Mark, it's a pretty long quote, but it's just Father Tadros mailed his commentary on it.
Anyway, there is much controversy as to the right order of seniority of Noah's sons. Some talk of them as Shem, Ham, and then Japheth. Based on the fact that they were mentioned as such in many locations in the Holy Book, and yet some others believe that although Shem was not the firstborn, yet he was put first because from him. The great fathers Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob came, and from him came the ancient people of whom the Lord Christ was born according to the flesh. What confirms this is that in chapter 10, the sons of Japheth were presented first, followed by those of Ham and then Shem. Some believe that the younger son here is Canaan, the grandson of Noah, and from his son, Ham. But it is more probably Ham himself.
Okay, so that's just a commentary about that for those of you who are interested, just to clear that up. Yeah. Canaan, yeah.
So the eight people being blessed by God and protected by God in the north, so Noah can't pronounce any curse against one of these being blessed by God.
Okay, that shows how well read Uncle Fedi is, because that's exactly what the fathers say.
Second one, there was a custom in the Old Testament that the curse could be carried through generation. So Canaan is the son of Ham. So he carried the sin of his father and bears the curse of his father. So this is why Christ came in the New Testament and he said, everyone will carry his mistake. He will carry his punishment against his sin. So, and he pronounced that no one can say anymore that the guilt of the father is carried to the son, or the son carried to the father. Everyone carries his guilt. So all this custom being carried until Christ came and acknowledged this fact that everyone will carry his guilt, not carried for generation from the son to the father, from the father to the son.
Yeah, and so the fathers say exactly what you said, that that Canaan, what was the first thing you said? Remind me? No, the first point you made. Oh, sorry, yeah, that he couldn't curse Ham because Ham was one of the blessed from God from the ark. A lot of the fathers said that. The other thing that a lot of them said was that that Canaan very likely was part of the mocking. In fact, was the instigator of Ham's mocking. We will never know that because it doesn't say anything about that, but that they speculate in that direction. The other thing to note is, notice Shem's blessing is, blessed be the Lord, the God of Shem. Does anyone know why Shem doesn't get a direct blessing, but the Lord, the God of Shem, gets a blessing? Extra marks for this one. Tough one. Huh? Ava. Maybe, but that's not the reason that that I read.
Churches, I will bless you, O Lord, which is from Psalm 25. And I will bless God because of Shem, for whom Christ has come to save the world.
That's exactly right. There it is. Because Shem, through Shem's genealogy, Christ came. So the blessing was to something much greater. Okay, was to Christ. Because from Shem's genealogy, Christ came. And that's why in that specific verse, the blessing is not on Shem directly. Just as a quick comment, again, for Mike's question, because I thought about an answer for your THC question while we were going. Basically, any other drug that you take has an immediate effect on your capacity to think, has an immediate effect on everything about you, your behavior. Alcohol doesn't. No, it doesn't. but it doesn't. It actually doesn't. There's a certain limit. That's why they allow you to drive with a certain amount of alcohol in your system, because it doesn't affect your reaction time, doesn't affect your behavior. That's one, maybe a reason. That's maybe a reason.
Yeah, well, it depends on where you are. Like, I think if you've got alcohol in LA, something like double what we have here, 6.1.
Yeah, but still, they all allow at something. And also, sometimes when you, like, for example, when we have communion or whatever, if I do the breath test, they don't pick it up. That's what I'm saying. That's what my point is, that it doesn't necessarily affect you to have some alcohol. Okay. Normally, when one standard drink is actually not more than a couple of mouthfuls. If you calculate it, a wine standard drink is not more than a couple of mouthfuls. So that's a reason. Do you have a question, Yusuf?
I just wondered, that even King Solomon said, why is not for kings to drink better to get the Lord, and of all people, you can be not forgetting the Lord?
A Christian. That's right. So we need to be very careful around alcohol.
I wish to read for you Proverbs 23, the last part of the chapter, where those who consume alcohol, but I don't want to pass the area of the severe punishment that Ham had and Canaan for stepping up against his dad. So if suppose that there is a law from tomorrow that euthanasia, that you can kill people, is appropriate. And they ask you, your dad has cancer and he's got, like, you know, he's suffering. Please put the plunge and kill your dad. Will you do that? Be careful, my friend. Well, even if he's a life support, your duty as a son is actually to honor your dad. Nowadays, we see it, like, sorry, I wanted to say it yani bluntly, but the newer generation, and this is one of the signs of the end of age, that a person can challenge, or a sister or daughter can challenge her mom, or can actually literally work towards inflicting harm to some of her ancestors. Example, like a grandmother could say, why should I care for grandmother? Just throw her in a nursing home. Why you bother myself? I need my space, I need my life, I need my job, I need my entertainment. I don't want my grandmother in my life because she's a burden on me. No, this is not honorable in the eyes of God. So again, I'll say it again. The commandment that says honor your father and your mother and you'll have a reward, you shall be well and live longer, is a commandment with a promise, but actually it's with a curse. And the curse here, if I challenge my dad or my mom, if I wish them something wrong, if I work intentionally towards harm towards them, I'm not going to get them punished in front of God. And the punishment is much, much, much more severe than the punishment of if I did the same mistake to another person. Example, in theology they say, example, a person commits adultery or fornication. Now, if you commit adultery against your stepmother or your mother, this is severe punishment compared to you commit adultery to your neighbor's wife or whatever. Sorry, I'm getting in sort of gross on details about this issue because nowadays, we as young people, sorry I wanted to say it, we can walk over our parents. Okay? But remember that. I will mention only one story. My dad was a priest for nearly 55 years. And one day, a young man came to him. He was in his 30s. And he said, Abuna, I want to get rid of my son. Slapped me in the face. And what makes things worse, when I talked to my grandfather, he said to me, I should forgive him. And he took me in a corner in the lounge room, and he said, do you remember my son in this corner? 20 years ago, you slapped me exactly in that same corner. And what you've done to me has been done by your son for you. You know what this father was punished by? He actually committed suicide. So he blasphemed against the Holy Spirit and he lost his eternity. Just for one reason, that he didn't want to pass on the same forgiveness that his dad forgave him, and it actually passed on. What's funny though, that he was very wealthy and he used to steal the money. He found him a millionaire. $1 million was in his tennis, was hidden after the life. But what's really disgusting is that nowadays, we as young people, we consider mom and dad to be some of which they are idiots, and that's wrong. That's totally wrong. Not leave alone what sheep, sorry, what Ham has done to his dad. What Ham has done to his dad, or what his, was really, really highlighted in the Bible, because the wrongs of my parents does not give me the right to do wrongs to me.